Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
The Dalai Lama was recently in Australia to give a five-day meditation session. He attracted hundreds of media and thousands of people, among them designer Jenny Key and meditation guru Paul Wilson. And I'll be speaking to them, as well as Bob Thurman, the director of Tibet House in New York City, and father of the newly engaged Uma Thurman. And of course, we hear from the Dalai Lama himself. This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, and I'm Rachel Kahn. The smiling Dalai Lama may look like he's permanently on cloud nine, but he's not without pressing problems. The major one, as we all know, is China's control of Tibet. Other problems are more like irritants, such as the protests of the Western Shugden Society, a rival movement begun in 1991 and based in London, that follows him around the world, chanting, "Dalai Lama, stop lying." And that refers to his proscription of that movement and its worship of what he calls a malevolent deity, Jorge Shugden. They don't accept the Dalai Lama as the leader of Tibetan Buddhism. But when the Dalai Lama arrived at his media conference in Sydney, he was his usual impish self.
Ladies and gentlemen, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama of Australia.
Since some media people want to see me, arrange our meeting. So my part is nothing to say.
Of course, that didn't stop him. Here's the Dalai Lama of Tibet, not Australia, giving one of his most important messages just before he answered questions. The Dalai Lama is believed to be the embodiment of the Bodhisattva of compassion.
On a human level, I'm one of the 6 billion human beings. Each individual human being's future, happy life, much depend on the rest of the 6 billion human beings. Your future much depend on rest of the world. The rest of the world's peace and the spirit of cooperation, then Australia also is to get maximum benefit. So each individual case also like that. My own case, I'm part of the human being. If humanity generally more fighting, more killing, then that fear, I also eventually, suffer, isn't it? So therefore, as my own sort of share of responsibility regarding 6 billion human beings, I always trying to make clear the ultimate source of happy life, peace of mind, is within ourselves. That is human affection, warm-heartedness, or another word, human compassion, which by birth we already equipped that, because we, everybody, come from our mother. So we survived and grown well under mother's affection. So we already got tremendous effect when we are young. So that I consider the basic human value. These values are secular values. And the method to promote these values also through secular way. That means use our common sense, common experience, and latest scientific finding. Nothing to do with religion. So that's my number one commitment. Number two commitment is promotion of religious harmony. I'm now speaking on the level of I'm Buddhist. Now today, it is very, very important to promote closer relation on the basis of mutual understanding, mutual respect, mutual admiration. It can be done. I am Buddhist. I understand, or I know, the value of these different traditions. The theory of God try to promote human compassion, human love. Everybody consider God is the fullest compassion. No one say God is fullest anger or hatred. Nobody say that. So the very concept of God is, you see, since we are creator of God, so the creator is the full of compassion. So all creation from that also, you see, by nature, the seed of compassion.
Next question up the back.
Your Holiness, you are credited with bringing boundless positivity to every situation. Do you see anything positive in the current situation between China and Tibet?
I'm optimistic, basically, because, firstly, People's Republic of China, same political system, one-party system, but today's China, compared 30, 40 years ago, much changed. Even such extent, some people say, communist capitalism. Isn't it? Communist capitalism. It is something very, very new. So I think the Deng Xiaoping, really realistic leader, so he considered, I mean, he saw economy, day-to-day human life is more important than simply ideology. So it is a realistic approach. So now recently, after this crisis happened, many articles wrote by many Chinese scholars, wonderful articles. These are reflection of deeper awareness about the true situation. So basically, I'm hopeful.
The unmistakable Dalai Lama at his Australian media conference. After it, I spied Paul Wilson, known for his books on meditation, and he's been a previous guest on The Spirit of Things.
Paul Wilson, it's nice to see you here, but I guess I could have expected that.
Well, it was hard to get here, but I made it.
Are you going to the meditation sessions today?
Tomorrow, yeah. So I haven't done the whole lot.
What was your impression of the press conference this morning with the Dalai Lama?
Well, I have attended other press conferences with the Dalai Lama, and they do have a certain political nature. And I admire the Dalai Lama's political skills. He's very deft at covering all these issues very well. From my personal point of view, I was hoping for a bit more coverage of the meditation and the spiritual side of what he's here for.
Well, did you get anything from his message this morning, his answers? Because he did manage to say a few words at the beginning about his philosophy of bringing harmony to the world and so forth.
And having every individual have a happy life and find peace of mind, which is something he says at all his press conferences, I believe. I did record something, and I haven't got the whole gist of it yet, but he did say some interesting things. He was using the word God and compassion, and we create God, so a little bit of a particular perspective there. I thought that was interesting.
I wonder whether this morning's press conference indicates the degree to which politics is uppermost in a lot of people's minds when they think of the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, very much so. 12 months ago, he did a press conference in Sydney, which I attended, and there was probably half a dozen journalists, half a dozen cameramen. This is still photographers. Today there was 200, I expect.
Do you think the political concerns are in conflict with his spiritual message, his spiritual role?
Well, I think that would be for him to say, but from my point of view, I find the great political coverage to be unsatisfying from what I would like to get out of it, because he does have a very big agenda in wanting to find some harmony in the world religions. And the political issues that come to the fore, I think, tend to confuse that a bit.
Do you think that meditation really has that sort of power, you know, to heal global conflicts, or is that putting too much of a burden on what meditation is for and what it can do?
Not at all. I think meditation brings peace of mind and peaceful feelings to the meditator. And the more people who meditate, even if it's only for a little bit, you do tend to create a kind of warm, compassionate environment amongst those who other people who meditate. And I find this a moment of treats. You can take two people who are enemies, and I did have one instance where I was working on a racism project, and I had two people who were genetic enemies. They had been brought up, both from the Middle East, to hate one another simply because of how they were born. And over the course of a retreat, a meditation retreat, I saw these people become, I wouldn't say brothers, but, you know, just found the common ground. And that's the power of meditation. And that's what he's here to spread. And hopefully it will just get more and more people just doing a little bit more focus in their meditation practice.
Well, Paul, I hope you get a lot out of tomorrow's meditation session. What were you actually doing here today? In what capacity?
Well, I have a little web adventure, and it's called millionmeditators.org. And the purpose of it is to try and get more and more people meditating, just a little, so it shares techniques and methods and insights from teachers around the world. And I've actually done an interview with the Dalai Lama from last year, which I'm waiting for a big enough audience to be able to release. But I've interviewed many teachers, which I will progressively be feeding out to the people who go to this website, who were sharing ways of finding a bit of peace of mind and spreading peace in the world.
Paul Wilson, spreading peace through his website, which you can find at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. While we were talking, thousands of people were waiting patiently in the dome at Sydney Olympic Park in Homebush, where 40 monks and nuns were quietly sitting on stage awaiting the Dalai Lama, who, when he arrived, climbed up on a throne and sat cross-legged on a cushion. It was a colourful setting, mainly gold and dark red, with six huge tankas, that is, silk paintings of Buddhist deities, hanging behind the Dalai Lama. During the lunch break, I caught up with Jenny Key, one of Australia's legendary designers and a Buddhist.
Jenny Key, it's great to talk to you for the Spirit of Things, and especially here in the dome at Homebush. On the second day of the Dalai Lama's teaching, were you here yesterday?
Yes, I've come for the whole 5 days. I think it's very special to have the Dalai Lama teaching on meditation, and that he's going to give the empowerment for Chenrezig on Sunday, to me, is just, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, because he is the embodiment of Chenrezig, which is the Buddha of compassion. And to get the empowerment from the Buddha of compassion in this modern time is as good as it gets.
What actually happens during that ceremony and practice?
You know, I do it sort of with my group in the mountains every week. And, you know, I actually can't visualize deities very well. But, you know, when I finish the practice, there is just this wave of compassion that I always feel. And, you know, it warms my heart. And I guess it's the most important requirement of Buddhism, because if we don't have the compassion, then that is the way of the Buddha.
How long have you been a practicing Buddhist?
I guess my first teacher was the most extraordinary and humble forest monk in Thailand. In 1986, I met Ajahn, and he taught me about the interconnectedness, and he taught it through sitting in the forest.
Is that Ajahn Brahm?
It's Ajahn Punsak, and he was a great, he still is, but he's very ill now. He was a great environmental campaigner, but he taught from the most extraordinary cave and the surrounds of the cave. He saved all the trees that were coming down the forest. The hill tribes were, you know, growing opium, and, you know, he really made a big campaign of environmental awareness from the Buddhist perspective of interconnectedness. The forest is our first home. And that was my first teacher, and I have to say that I came to Tibetan Buddhism when my partner committed suicide 7 years ago now.
That was Danton Hughes?
That was Danton. And, you know, what we're hearing, this beautiful chant, I played it, you know, I played it for 6 months, day and night. And when I walked into this hall yesterday, it filled me with the feeling that I had when Danton first died. And I just had this unbelievable sort of like I thought that's why I went to Tibetan Buddhism, because it gave me the answers about suffering and the pain. And then, you know, one incredible lama said to me, but when you pray for Danton, Jenny, pray for all the Dantons. That's how you will develop compassion. Pray for all the sad, lonely, depressed people that have committed suicide. And then it just wasn't my pain. And I really understood from personal experience really the depth of compassion, that we don't do it for ourselves. We have to think of the bigger picture. And then it just becomes not my pain, but the pain of the world, the pain of the world's suffering. And that really taught me from my own experience what it really means to have compassion.
Why did you move specifically to Tibetan Buddhism? Did the Dalai Lama have a particular hold on you? Were you fascinated by him?
No, it was the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. It was the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying that I just knew I couldn't sit through my pain. I couldn't just breathe in and breathe out. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying just helped me. It became my Bible. And I had many extraordinary experiences after that period. But do you know what? You know what? Here we are, and it's like 7 years later from Tibetan Buddhism and 25 years later from my Buddhist monk. Do you know, I sit here, and this teachings is called the stages of meditation, and all I want to be able to do in this life, and I feel very humble when I say it, is I just want to be a good meditation. I want to be able to sit well. If I can just achieve that before I die, you know, in many lives to come, I'll become a good Vajrayana practitioner and maybe I'll be able to, you know, realise the deities. But really, I really feel that I've gone back to basics. I just want to be able to really develop awareness and have a good sitting practice. That's sort of how I feel now, and it's sort of quite liberating.
Well, Jenny, we all know you as a fashionista, a kind of, you know, an aid to the material girl, a brilliant designer who makes us all look more beautiful. How did that go with being a Buddhist, which teaches non-attachment and which often is associated with a repudiation of the material life?
Well, the fact is, you can have your passion and your passion in your work, and then you do it and you can let go of it. You see, I mean, you know, and you know what? I have a great passion. I've designed a scarf out there where they're selling in the other hall, and it's for Lotus Outreach. And that is Zonza Kensi's group. And he is doing work in Cambodia with the sexually abused and the sex trade, educating the young girls, getting them to, the education will give them the opportunity to be more than sex slave workers. I designed a beautiful scarf which will then support that whole movement, and I think it's a wonderful thing because, you know, Cambodia is one of the poorest Asian countries, and that's where, you know, the sex, you know, the trade moves in to the poorest countries and takes those children as young as 6 months old and babies, and I mean, it's just horrific. So my work, back to me, my beautiful designs have gone into that. And then I've got another beautiful lama, Kandro, and I particularly love Kandro because she is a woman, and I will be doing something beautiful design-wise for her. And, you know, and that means that I have my passion, but I can give it out just for the love.
Nonetheless, have you found that Buddhist teachings have been helpful in this tendency that we all have in the prosperous
world,
the prosperous world, in the prosperous West, to attach to things, to surround ourselves with material things? Has Buddhism helped you?
Yes, it has, because you know, I lead a much more humble life. I mean, I actually don't drive; I walk everywhere, and you know, I live in a beautiful recycled house that is not taking too much from resources. I have an incredibly beautiful native garden that is not taking water. You know, I sort of think I live my truth in my humble way. I mean, I'm not to be set up as an example, but, you know, and when I have to be the designer, she comes out and she does the work she's meant to do. But my love and my passion is my Buddhist path.
What about the teachings here? The Dalai Lama today, for example, was assisted by his tutor, and sometimes the Dalai Lama has difficulty getting the right word. He's a halting speaker at times. I just wonder, does that add to his charm to you, or does it impede your reception of the teachings?
No, I do find these teachings very dense, they're very... they're very in the mind, some. But I'm all in the heart. And if I can just sit in his presence for these next 5 days and get the empowerment of Chinrezig at the end on the Sunday, it'll be the greatest blessing I think I can have.
Can I ask you to just describe the qualities of the Dalai Lama that makes being in his presence a bounty for you?
He is just the embodiment of compassion. I mean, his way of dealing with China, you know, we all know that things have changed, you know. And look, one Lama said to me, the Chinese, through communism, have got clear minds. They are starved for spiritual understanding. And now the time is so ripe for Buddhism to really go into China in the most magnificent way. So if that is, you know, and the Dalai Lama can see that. These beings can see far beyond where we are now, you know, and that's what I guess I love about the Dalai Lama, is that he sees things beyond this ordinary realm that we're living in.
As a Chinese Australian, do you find this conflict right now? Do you experience it kind of personally? Is it painful for you?
No, because you know what? I grew up as an Australian, Italian, Chinese, and I've always felt like an outsider as a Chinese. I've always felt like an outsider as an Italian, but as an Aussie, I feel like this is where I belong.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Rachel.
Jenny Key lives in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales and remains a dedicated follower of fashion and Buddhism. Her recent biography is called A Big Life. Coming up, Bob Thurman. Robert Thurman is an affable big bear of a person who's probably the envy of Buddhist scholars everywhere. His daughter is the beautiful Uma Thurman, and these days you're more likely to catch him on late-night talk shows spruiking the Tibetan cause than at academic conferences. His latest book is Why the Dalai Lama Matters, which includes a 5-step plan to solve the China-Tibet problem. We didn't quite get to that, but I can tell you it included making Tibet the spa capital of the world. I reached him in London. Robert Thurman, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you, Rachel. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been a friend of the Dalai Lama for some 40 years now. How did you first meet?
We first met when introduced by an elderly Mongolian Lama who had been in Tibet for 35 years and had then been in America by that time for about 20 years, 10 years actually. Then he brought me there to Dharamsala to study with His Holiness and His Holiness's teachers and His Holiness's physician in 1964. His Holiness was just about to give a speech at the World Fellowship of Buddhists in Sarnath in India when we first met. He was sort of sweeping out grandly, and we stopped and chatted, and he, as he always does with everybody that he ever meets, he gave me his full attention, which was impressive even then, although I didn't really understand how impressive until years later.
Did he act in the way that you expected of a Dalai Lama? Did he sort of fulfill those expectations of yours?
Well, at that time, I didn't really realize what was a Dalai Lama particularly. I was only interested in Buddhist philosophy and meditation. I had no interest in the politics or history. I didn't really know a lot about Tibet. I was only interested in attaining nirvana, if you will, and so very much wanted to be a Buddhist monk at that time because that's all I wanted to do. I saw him as a senior monk and as a hope to ordain me, because the old Mongolian Lama of mine who had taught me so beautifully, but he had advised me not to become a monk because I wouldn't permanently stay one, he said, but I was so sure that I would listen. So he then brought me to see His Holiness, saying that maybe His Holiness will decide to ordain you. He was 29, I was 23. Neither of us listened to the old Mongolian Lama, because the Dalai Lama was new to the West, really. He'd only been in exile at that time for 5 years, and also in the kind of bubble in Dharamsala, where you have a little tiny drop of Tibetan civilization still existing even then. And it's such an easy thing to be a monk and stay a monk in Tibetan civilization that he thought it'd be fine. And we didn't see the future, either of us, I think, at that point.
Well, in those heady days in the 60s, there was a lot of interest in the West, in Mao and his little red book. I imagine you had a very different view.
I never believed in materialism as a philosophy, and I always thought nothing was nothing. Eureka. And on the other hand, I was not a theist. I was not a religious believer either. That's why Buddhism in the middle there made me very happy when I discovered its thought. But I didn't really go for it as a religion. It was like, this is the reasonable science and insight into the nature of the world. That's what I was looking for.
How long did you remain a monk?
I lived as a monk for about 3.5 years, but I was formally ordained only about 1.5 years. I wasn't able to stay in Dharamsala in India for that long. There were visa issues, financial issues. I had to go back to the West. And in the West at that time, there was, as you note, with Mao's little red book and the West's own preoccupations, a Protestant sort of notion about monasticism, there was no support whatsoever for anybody to be a monk.
Well, you certainly did end up leaving the monastic life, and you got married to a Swedish model and became an academic at Harvard, specializing in Tibetan Buddhism. Did you miss living a monk's life when you went back to America?
A bit, yes, I did. But I don't know. Well, my wife might tell you I remained a monk mentally in that I remained to sort of focused on what I do and a bit of a workaholic, or as she jokingly calls me, a Buddhaholic. Yes. So I remained a Buddhaholic as a professor, although children did distract a lot, and I got to enjoy living the lay life, I must admit. Then later I studied very carefully the history of Tibet, and I discovered that monasticism is a major institution historically invented by the Buddha, mainly shared between Buddhism and Christianity in the ancient period. Then later you have some Hindu monastics. It is the one institution worldwide that ever successfully demilitarized any society or even moderated the influence of militarism. And therefore, something that we need today, actually. Dalai Lama likes to joke, among the ex-monks, I'm the most enthusiastic about monasticism that he knows.
Now, Robert, through all your professional pressures of academia and also the demands of family life, which you obviously enjoyed, especially as you came to have a famous Hollywood movie star daughter.
We're very blessed, yes.
Indeed. Well, how did you manage to keep a close connection to the Dalai Lama through all that?
Well, I remain very interested in the Dharma. I feel that Buddhism needs to be studied in Western academies as a philosophy, as a psychology, and a science, and its history of the Buddhist civilizations are very important in relation to ethics and politics. And so I have pursued it with great focus in that way. And then His Holiness, you know, being a great friend, and the Tibetan plight being so important to the world and trying to ameliorate that situation, and also the whole issue of dealing between the West and China. So all of these naturally made us colleagues in a certain way, even though I wasn't a monk, you know, and actually it made me able to be more helpful to him as a member of Western society that could speak from a certain academic platform in Western society. So we remain close colleagues, really, in addition to being close friends. And spiritually, he grew tremendously, or my ability to perceive where he was grew enough that I could perceive what an extraordinary teacher he is also. Mm. And so I learned a great deal from him. I'm very grateful to him.
Well, you've certainly been a real advocate of the Dalai Lama through your co-founding of Tibet House in New York, mm-hmm. which I've been mm-hmm. privileged to visit. It's a very beautiful place with lots of wonderful art. Is that also yes. where you organize a lot of his public schedule, like his meetings with international dignitaries?
Not really. When we host him in New York, which we do sometimes, we do organize a little bit his meeting, but he has a representative in America that is the main organizer of all his trips. And we are just one of the institutions that he supports. and patronizes. We are the cultural, main cultural venue for His Holiness. But we don't manage his schedule, and he has quite a team that does that.
Mm. Well, you certainly would have witnessed many occasions in which the Dalai Lama addresses foreign dignitaries as well as American ones.
Yes, certainly.
What effect does he have on his audience?
Well, the Dalai Lama always has an amazing effect on the audience, I think, whether it's one person or 30,000 persons, because of the nature of his awareness, which is genuine altruism. And that means that he genuinely looks at things from others' perspectives. It isn't just some sort of sentimental thing, oh, I care for you, or sanctimonious thing. He's very normal in his way of talking and being with people. But it's that they feel the focus of his attention on them and their purpose. It's like, you know, when you're in a room with someone who's very full of themselves, if they're an interesting person, it can still be fun. But it's very different from being in a room with someone who's not so interested in themselves as they are in you. And that puts a certain focus on you, and your own awareness about yourself is heightened in a certain way, and you feel relieved, actually, and pleased. So people just blossom in his presence, actually. I've seen people come in who have a preconceived idea about him, and then when they meet him, actually, they feel very relaxed, and their own thoughts come clearly to them in a certain way. Or they forget what they'd planned to discuss, and they talk about something much more deeply.
Well, you've referred to the Dalai Lama's almost superhuman presence and his magic. You use that word. Wouldn't he be embarrassed by such a description? Wouldn't he deny it?
He might. I don't know. It would depend. He would make a joke. I remember him once telling a story about how a Tibetan gentleman had come to see him in Dharamsala and was very troubled about finding a certain relative who may or may not have escaped from Tibet and so on, and had to wait a week or two to see him. And during that time had a dream in which the Dalai Lama told him, stop waiting around to see me, get yourself to Kathmandu because your relative is there and you need to see. He needs to see you. He's leaving for Tibet very soon. So the man jumped in a bus and went to Kathmandu in Nepal and did find his relative and then came back and thanked the Dalai Lama for giving him such wonderful advice, clairvoyant advice. And the Dalai Lama was laughing because he said he had no idea of this, but it certainly was an efficient way of dealing with his appointments in case he could tell him something in the dream without even being aware of it himself. And he was laughing madly about that incident. So I suggested that he create a dreamatorium motel nearby his residence and have people just wait there and have dreams, and then he would have a much lighter schedule. he thought that was very funny.
Yes, and indeed I think part of his charm and appeal is his readiness to laugh and to enjoy himself. But let's get serious here. I mean, you have described the Dalai Lama as one of the world's greatest scientists, the Einstein of our day. What do you mean by that?
Well, Buddhism is thought of as a religion, and the Buddha sometimes as a religious founder or prophet. In his enlightenment is described and very carefully defined as an awareness of the nature of reality, not as a revelation from a god. He had some meetings with different gods, but their statements to him were not satisfying to him, and so he continued to examine the nature of the world internally and externally and eventually came up with his own insight into what its true nature is. And so it's based on the confidence that the human being has the ability to understand their world. And not only that, but that in order to achieve freedom from suffering, your salvation, if you will, in the Western sense, that is only achieved by understanding. It cannot be achieved just by faith, by believing in someone else, either divine or human. And therefore, Buddha has been an educational system and, if you will, a scientific system from the beginning, in the sense that it has always posited that through an investigation of the nature of reality and thereby discovering that nature, that's where you get freedom from suffering. That's where you discover happiness. Therefore, the Dalai Lama is being someone who has used that teaching and that education to the very, very fullest in this life, and at least for sure, and according to their view, the Buddhist view, in many lives. He's someone who understands the way the mind works very clearly, understands the nature of reality very clearly, which makes him a scientist, actually. And of course, another interesting thing is understanding it doesn't necessarily mean being able to reduce it to a formula or some sort of simple aphorism or a mathematical equation. It means being one with that reality and actually experiencing how it does work and being able to tune yourself to that working. So it leaves you open-minded about other people's attempts to describe it and encouraging of them, and it's not a dogmatic thing. In other words, understanding reality doesn't mean that therefore it must be described in this and that dogmatic way. So Buddhism is further scientific in the sense that all theories are hypotheses awaiting falsification by further experience, if you will. Mm. But, of course, this is not like Western. Western science is dogmatically trapped in materialism. That is to say, only matter matters, and there's nothing that isn't gross matter and that we can't pin down with external observation and measurement. You know, all these kind of dogmas under which Western science operates are not necessarily operative within Buddhism. It's even more open and less dogmatic than materialist science.
I guess that's particularly apparent when the Dalai Lama makes statements, as he did to the Australian media recently when he was asked about the earthquake in China. He partly attributed it to karma. Now, that would strike many people as, you know, incredibly unscientific, you know, against the scientific explanation of what causes earthquakes. So is there, in fact, a kind of science of karma, do you think?
Yes, of course. Not only that, karma, the reason people think of that as unscientific is they're thinking that karma means some sort of fate, something like God's will or something like that, some mysterious thing. Karma simply means action. Or causality, you could say causation. The most famous verse about the Buddha's discovery that the Buddhists have repeated for thousands of years is Om Ye Dharma Hetu Prabhava, and so on. That's Sanskrit, and it means, I celebrate the Buddha as the one who discovered causation. You know, that things have effects, and what those causes of those effects are, and how to intervene in the processes of causation. Therefore, it's very much a scientific thing. So when he says it's karma, he means it's a kind of causation. And by that, he means the physical things about the planet are interwoven with the human being's minds, because the mind is a powerful energy in nature, and that energy is engaged in sort of the way atoms work and the way molecules work and the subatomic energies. Mm. And so there's no such thing as some sort of abstract bunch of tectonic plates that just completely grind along in their own causation without being interwoven with the living beings associated with them. So it's a very interesting and subtle thing. He shouldn't probably say karma because people will misunderstand that to mean fate or something like
that.
Yes, yeah. But that is not what it means. It actually means causation. And scientists are definitely the people who seek to understand things by analyzing them in terms of their causes.
Is that what you mean then when you say that the Dalai Lama can cause an inner revolution in the people and thereby cause an outward change in the world?
Yes. His slogan is world peace through inner peace. And what he means by that is that if people would address the conflicts and problems and difficulties that we all face, human-made, many of them, some nature-made, you could say, but they address them in a calm and altruistic and more global, insightful way, instead of pursuing emotional things dictated by egotism and selfishness and therefore engaging in violence. But if we did it the other way, we could solve every problem. This planet, human beings have evolved in relation to this planet. If we managed it intelligently and reasonably, there really would not be any problem. And that is how he thinks. So for example, he and I were once walking in a city, going back to his hotel from a teaching in a wealthy area because they put him in a nice hotel, and yet there were homeless people in the street out in front of the Gucci stores and this kind of thing. And so he sadly turns to me and he says, you know, 100 years ago, there was too much concentration of wealth like there is today. And then there were these violent revolutions, and they sort of took everything away from the wealthy people. But then the people who took it away turned out to be worse in managing things and caused the death of many, many millions of people. What to do? What to do? It was rhetorically asking a question. So naturally, I give him his own teaching and say, well, the wealthy people this time have to learn the lesson of history, and they have to give it away. And we both looked dubious, actually, although I was reciting what the Buddhist, you know, generosity is the key, is a key. But however, 2 or 3 weeks later, or maybe a month later, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates started their process of giving their hundreds of billions away.
Well, that seems to be one of the paradoxes of the West, because although it can be held up for scorn as, you know, the den of materialism, it's mm-hmm. also the West which generates all of this wealth, which helps to support the Dalai Lama and Tibet House and many of the other vehicles for spreading the Dalai Lama's message.
Sort of, yes. But I'm sorry, I consider that we live in what I call a not-quite post-colonial age. And so the wealth that is generated does come from somewhere. And if you look at the condition of Africa and much of the Americas, or even of our own, I don't know Australia well, but in America we have these terrible inner cities, very much divided along racial lines. We have over 2 million people, mostly people of color, in prisons. You know, it's not yet a situation where human intelligence producing wealth based on reasonable interventions in nature, also taking care of nature at the same time and taking care of people at the same time. Of course, communism was stupid in the sense that everybody shares everything, nobody owns anything, and therefore actually nobody has anything. That turned out to be a big disaster and led to a lot of violence. But some kind of greater ethic about sharing and socialistic kind of view, I think, is very important. And the unrestrained capitalism, you say it generates wealth, and it does for a few, but it may be that the cost to the environment, one of the great problems of economics, as I understand it, is it considers nature's contributions as a zero-sum thing. The trees, you know, the air, the water, it's just free. It just comes free. And then you have gross domestic product, gross national product. And then the waste and the taking care of the garbage that is produced as the byproducts of all of your industrial cycles, that's also free, and nature is supposed to take care of it. And so what we're finding at the end of 300, 400, 500 years of industrialization, and some latecomers, you know, in Asia jumping into it with both feet and heedless and recklessly, we're finding that our planet, instead of generating a lot of wealth, we're destroying our planet. Mm. And what is it going to cost to fix it? Now, that's so I think there's a more balanced way of doing it, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
And this, again, will depend on, you know, overcoming war depends on the inner peace of overcoming hatred and violence. But overcoming planetary destruction involves the overcoming of inner greed and dissatisfaction and consumerism, excessive consumerism. Mm. And so I don't think we can think of the Western industrial developmental model as an unqualified boon to humanity. Its unrestrained form is potentially ultimately destructive.
That was Robert Thurman speaking to me from London. He's based in New York, where he's director of Tibet House and is the author of numerous books on Buddhism, including Why the Dalai Lama Matters. You're with the Spirit of Things, and we're considering the challenges ahead for the Dalai Lama and for the world. My guest is Robert Thurman, who was the first Westerner that the Dalai Lama ordained back in 1964. Well, Robert Thurman, you've said that the Dalai Lama should be included in an international register of the 10 most influential living people in the world. I often wonder whether he would have been the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and the recent U.S. Congressional Medal if he didn't actually have an influential support group that pushes him to the forefront.
I don't really think so. For example, at one point, Time magazine said I was one of the influential people in America. And I was in a sort of panel, a rogues gallery with George Soros and Madeleine Albright and such people. And I have no influence in my own household. My children laugh when I say something, and although they like me, and they're sweet to me, and I think it's just kind of silly. The Chinese are always saying the Dalai Lama has some sort of clique that is promoting him and all this kind of thing. I don't think so. I think the people of the world, one of the good byproducts of industrialization and technology and invention, is that due to the information explosion, the people of the world are poised to have finally some control over their lives and influence in their societies, democracy, and so on. I think they're held totally back by a militarized oligarchy that does not actually share the power with them and does not exert their will. For example, something like the Iraq War. The reason I say Dalai Lama should be included there is that he wins opinion polls of popularity. He's neck and neck with Angela Merkel in Germany. He's neck and neck with the Pope in Catholic countries. when they do these popularity polls. And it's people like a man who speaks for peace in this world, which is not very peaceful, and we're all under this threat of terror and all this kind of thing all the time from our governments and our media. He may get a Nobel Peace Prize, but then prime ministers won't meet with him if the Chinese put too much pressure. The Chinese won't listen to him, where he could solve the problem they're having about Tibet and even internally in their own country with their own spirituality, the ambivalence that they have about their communism inherited from Mao in recent decades or one century, and their long age-old spiritual tradition that is what made them happy as a nation for thousands of years. And they're in this kind of conflict. So put it this way, he is influential because he speaks for the human being and even for the animal that is being destroyed on this planet and nature. But that popularity is not translating into influence. Tibet is still ignored by all the governments of the world. So I'm saying this influence does not yet translate into actual changing of the behavior of nations. And there's a kind of mental genocide of the Tibetan people in the sense that everyone has some agenda with China, and therefore they don't dare speak up for the fact that self-determination on this planet should definitely lead to Tibetan people's freedom. And even so much so that the Dalai Lama himself doesn't even ask for independence, full independence, even though he deserves it. He says, we'll be part of China, no problem, but at least give us internal freedom on our own land, that where we can be in our own house.
Well, I've always been struck by the simplicity of the Dalai Lama's message when he does give talks. However, in your latest book, Why the Dalai Lama Matters, in which you make a very strong case for him as a sort of messianic figure, you almost appear like the Elijah who's foretelling the Messiah's coming, or John the Baptist who's foretelling Jesus coming as the Messiah.
Dear.
Do you think the time is ripe? And is that your role? Is that what you see as your role? That although he's very popular, you're wanting to kind of make the way straight for him to achieve these ends?
Well, maybe. It's kind of a funny thing, though. You see, Buddhism has a different view of messianic figures. In the West, there's this idea gotten from a tribe in the Eastern Mediterranean thousands of years ago, that there's sort of one God that only works through that tribe, and then there's one Messiah that better come back quick before we destroy ourselves. Or maybe we will destroy ourselves, and then one group of people will get to go to heaven. Everybody else will go down in the roasting pit. In Asia, starting in India and spreading everywhere in Asia under the aegis of Mahayana Buddhism, universal vehicle Buddhism, there's an idea that the divine and the enlightened forces in the universe, you could say, are omnipresent. There's many messiahs. They're female ones, male ones. They're those who appear like kings, which is what the Hebrew meaning of messiah is. And there are those who just appear as ordinary beings. And so we have lots of help, all of us. There are messiahs in every generation. We're always being helped by people. And under that view, in Asia, they became actually more peaceful in ancient time, relatively speaking. Nobody yet is perfect on this planet, no society, no person, except maybe the Buddha, and maybe there are a few invisible Buddhas too. But anyway, in those societies, they got more peaceful. They didn't decide to go conquer the world. They decided to live in their own areas with what they had. You know, I'm one who says that the conquest of Asia by the Europeans is not a sign of the superiority of the Europeans at all. It's a sign of the barbarism of the Europeans, I'm sorry. But, you know, who thinks that the biggest bully on the block is the most civilized? I don't think anybody. Mm. I think the civilized person is the gentle person who therefore is vulnerable. And so when you say, am I the Elijah and so on, well, I'm trying to, and I think the Dalai Lama does too, to call upon the world in this late stage of history where we've reached, you know, what Al Gore, I mean, is Al Gore a messianic figure? What is he doing, saying an inconvenient truth? He's saying that we have actually reached a point where we have a responsibility to recognize that we could destroy all life on Earth, and we're close to doing so. And therefore, we really have to change our way of living and way of producing and way of breathing and, you know, electric lights, whatever. If Al Gore is an Elijah, okay, I'm an Elijah, in the sense that I'm saying that mentally speaking, we have to come to a higher level of ethics, and we are able to live at a higher level And we are able to be more happy, actually.
Speaking of the pursuit of happiness, your daughter, Uma, has just announced her engagement to one of the world's richest men, Arki Bousson, which is why you're in London, so congratulations. But I note he's funded many charitable causes. Are you hoping to persuade him to support the Tibetan cause?
Not particularly, no. We have a family rule that we don't mix our own agendas with our children's lives. And Uma herself has been very supportive of the Tibetan cause, but also she supports children in Harlem and all kinds of other things. And if the Dalai Lama had a budget himself, you know, if he had a country and therefore a foreign aid budget, you can better believe he would be out in Africa looking at these poor children who are starving and having their parents died of AIDS and what have you and are uneducated, and these poor women who are oppressed and being forced to have 12 children and so forth with no education and no defense against various kinds of really backward, tyrannical males. That's what he would be doing. So he would be doing what Arki Bousson does himself. And so there's no way we're going to say, oh, stop doing that and only help Tibet. Tibet is a very key thing, and those who come to understand it and feel grateful to it will work to try to see that reason prevails in relation to Tibet for the benefit of China as well as Tibet, and the benefit of India, certainly, and Pakistan and all these neighbor countries. His Holiness once at an award ceremony we had at Tibet House, thanking people who had helped Tibet, different causes, and also we shared that with other Tibetan organizations. He thanked them all for helping and said, we'll ask you for help in the future. It's great, great, great. He said, but one way you can really help Tibet is, you know what? Help other causes. He said, help the whales. Help people in Africa. Help people right here in New York in your own slums. And that's our attitude. You know, it's all interconnected. And we don't have any such hope. And we don't care whether Arki has money or not has money. Point is, Uma loves him and he loves her. And that's really important.
That's wonderful to hear.
And actually, money is a burden today because there's so many people who need it. And having a bunch of it puts a very heavy duty and responsibility on you, and you can't really relax and have a good time. You have to worry about the impact of it, and you have to do good things with it, or you're worthless.
Robert Thurman was professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University in New York. But he was in London for his daughter Uma Thurman's engagement party to the billionaire Arki Bousson. I bet they weren't drinking tea with yak butter. And if you're listening to this program on Sunday, the Dalai Lama turns 73 today. That is by normal reckoning. But if he is reincarnated 14 times, well, you figure it out. I hope you enjoyed today's program on the Dalai Lama, whose popularity is so great despite the Tibetans numbering only around 6 million. You'll be able to download this program or listen to it online at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And there are also pictures there of the Dalai Lama at the media conference and at his teaching sessions. Production was by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. And thanks to Lila Schooner for recording the media conference. In a couple of weeks, we'll be reporting from the front lines of the Pope's visit for World Youth Day. But next week, we go backstage to visit a man who's been chaplain to actors and all the other nervous artists who know the show must go on. That's Albert McPherson, the actor's chaplain, next week on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.